The photographs are instantly recognizable. Two trains head-to-head, men in dusty coats and hats gathered around the space between. The image of driving the spike linking the Central Pacific and Union Pacific Railroads at Promontory Summit, Utah, is an enduring metaphor in the American narrative, representing a triumph of individualism and capitalism, a process that may have contained dark elements but that nonetheless transformed us into a modern nation. In Railroaded, The Transcontinental in the Making of Modern America, Professor Richard White offers a very different view on the building of the Transcontinental Railroads and their impacts on the nation, a view in which corporate greed and political corruption spill out onto a transnational stage for the very first time in our nation, and which bears an unsettling resemblance to more recent financial troubles. A winner of the MacArthur Award, the Parkman Prize, and currently the Margaret Byrne Professor of American History at Stanford University, Professor White joins us today to talk about his latest work and this remarkable period. Thank you, Professor White, for joining us at KBOO.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Dave.
Well, you know, it's the traditional myth, as I kind of indicated, is that, you know, the Transcontinental Railroads, we had scoundrels building them, but in the end, they were scoundrels who knew what they were doing, and we ended up with this important infrastructure that made it possible for us to become a modern nation. You seem to have a slightly different view, both of the scoundrels and of, you know, what the product of their work was.
Yeah, I think the way the story is usually told is that it ends with the iconic moment that you just described. It's those two trains at Promontory Summit. It's 1869. The railroad's been completed, and the future rolls out from there. My book is essentially what happens over the next 30 years. And my argument is that not only that railroad, the Central Pacific and Union Pacific, the Pacific Railway, but the other transcontinentals were built in the United States, Canada, and Mexico, were premature, did more damage than good, and were ultimately failures. So my book is about how modernity comes out not so much from the success of capitalism, but from its failures.
Well, one of the things that immediately strikes the reader is that these groups of men were incredibly ignorant about the railroad business and many other things. I mean, for example, as you point out, in the Central Pacific, the Big Four were, they ran stores.
Yeah, and this is usually celebrated about them. They usually said that these are men of such incredible vision that when nobody else dared to take the risk, they stepped forward and took the risk. The reason nobody took the risk is anybody who knew anything about railroads didn't want to get involved in this. There were perfectly competent railway men all over the United States. The United States already was a leading railway nation. All of them looked at these projects and realized that you could not make money selling transportation. What the Big Four thought, well, you know, what you could make money from is financing these railroads and building these railroads. And they were more interested in getting in than getting out. They become railroad barons almost by accident because they are unable to sell out before the crash of 1873, which brings down virtually all of these. And once they're into it, they stumble on from there. So mine is a story of people who get in over their heads. But if they're good at anything, they're, I guess, good at swimming. They managed to stay afloat when many others sank.
Well, is it correct in saying that one of the things that these men created beyond, you know, the railroads was a new model or a new corporate structure which represented this relationship between, you know, very large corporations, the political system, and even the media to some extent?
Oh, without the government and without the new technologies of media, mass circulation newspapers and the telegraph, these railroads would not have existed. So one of the things that happens, it's these railroads find that to survive, they really have to control federal subsidies, protect their interests, and try to eliminate as much competition as possible. One of the things that I argue in the book is that this isn't just the story of how government subsidized railroads, but how modern corporations move into the government itself to compete with each other, that they literally make the government part of this kind of business competition. And the result is incredible corruption, which starts in the late 19th century. And it isn't constant through American history, but I would argue that the times when there's least regulation of corporations and when, in fact, they define the government can protect them, those are the times where you're going to have the most corruption. It begins in the 1860s, 1870s. And what these guys are selling essentially is information, much like our current financial system. Whoever controls information really can make a huge amount of profit. As long as you can disguise the weakness behind what you're doing and you know when to get out before others, then you can become very, very rich, even though the structure beneath the whole thing is pretty rotten.
One of the things that seemed essential to that is this kind of concept or idea of friends, which you go on actually quite some length and sort of defining how they define their relationships. Even I love this, the mention of, it sounded like Quaker meetings. But what exactly for these men was the idea of having friends?
It's one of the things that first puzzled me in the book. It's part of my technique as a scholar, is that, and then sometimes my technique, I'm kind of slow as a scholar. I was reading this correspondence for about 2 years, and I noticed these guys always refer to each other as friends, which at first I didn't think much about, but then as I got to know them, I realized these guys hated each other, but they still call each other friends. So my question became, what does friend mean? Well, in the 19th century, friend meant reciprocity. It didn't mean you had to like each other. It didn't mean that, in fact, you even had to respect each other. What it meant is you had to need each other and that you had to have a merging of interests where, in fact, you will protect their interests and they will protect yours. This is not the same thing as bribery. Bribery is can be a one-time transaction. It's a sort of retail transaction. You pay for a vote. And when they had to, these guys would bribe congressmen. But friends, it's a long-term relationship. A friend can't always be counted on, but a friend can be counted on most of the time. And the reward is not for a particular act, but for a relationship. So that over time, what a friend will get is business from the railroads. They'll get gifts from the railroads, from land grants. If a senator owns a company, they will get, in fact, contracts from the railroads. If they're lawyers, they will argue railroad cases before the Supreme Court. But mostly what they'll get is information. What the railroads will tell you, invest now. Take your money out now. Information can be turned into money, and this kind of reciprocity of giving public goods, which is what Congress has for private favors, which is the information that the railroads convey, is the essence of friendship.
And it appeared to be an offer that not many of our elected officials could resist.
No, there are elected officials who will resist it, but there are very many who can't. I mean, one of the odd things I found about the Gilded Age is that it's a period of great corruption, but it's also a period of great reform. And I came to have a great deal of respect, though I realized that many of the qualities they had were very dangerous, of the anti-monopolists who struggle against the railroads. Eventually, it will take a long time, but eventually they will bring the railroads and corporations to heel. But so it's a long battle. There are many friends of the railroads, but everybody is not a friend of the railroads.
And as I mentioned earlier, part of this puzzle, of course, or part of this structure they constructed was tapping into the kind of growth of modern media, which is sort of a fascinating dynamic where they're trying to, influence the press so that it'll influence the business environment.
Yeah, what these guys operate on is credit. So for them, the most important thing in the world is whether people will invest their money with them. I mean, this is all kinds of parallels with the modern financial system. And the people are far away, let's say, from California or New Mexico or any of the places they're building railroads. So what they have to make sure is that the information that will go to bankers and investors is the information that they want. And they want to make sure the bad information doesn't get to them. So what they will do is try very hard to control newspapers, to control the telegraph, to control anything that can convey bad information and to counter it. That very often they will intervene in the stock market when there's bad political news they know is going to hurt them. They will go in and start buying up their own bonds to make it appear as if there's a great deal of demand for the investments in the railroad. They will manipulate both the information and the stock market in order to make it seem that what are very dangerous investments are, in fact, very safe investments. And they're not always good at this. I mean, they do fail, but they showed me, at least, that in the late 19th century and probably in the early 21st century, I would never trust my money to any system where the information is asymmetric as this one is. They have a great deal of information. The investors have very little, and this is a recipe for disaster if you're investing money in these corporations.
I was also quite surprised because, again, that's really not part of the, you know, sort of the general metaphor we get in learning about this period. The fact that, you know, this really was a transnational event. The same players were involved in developing railroads in Canada and Mexico as well.
Yeah, these are, if you give them subsidies, they will come, seems to be the lesson. And this happens at about the same time in Canada and Mexico. And at first, I started to write a book contrasting the transcontinental railroads in the United States with those in Canada and with those in Mexico, until I found out these are all my guys. These are all the same guys. They're all drawing capital from the same region. Their railroads interconnect. This is one large continental system which is being constructed in the 1870s, 1880s, all across Western North America. So I was very surprised to find that, too. I expected these to be quite discrete national railroad systems, but they're not. All of them have in common the same people running them, the same subsidies by the government, the same sources of capital, and the same techniques.
You know, I'm interested, too, as well, your decision to insert those sort of small vignettes that are much more personal and I think very revealing. For example, the story you tell about Huntington, who's on the train, that his personal train that injures an individual. I mean, was your goal to humanize these people, which they still come away, you know, fairly flawed individuals? But what was your thinking behind that?
Well, one of the things, I wrote the book, I thought, well, this is turning into a very different book than the kind I usually write. These are about very powerful, as you say, very flawed, but very powerful figures who are pretty well known, at least among historians. And what I'm losing here is what all this meant to daily life of Americans, Canadians, or Mexicans. And so as I began to think about that, I also began to stumble over these stories in the archives, these little vignettes that begin and end. You don't know what happens much after that. And the stories were so compelling that I began to use them as a way to lower the scale of the book, to bring it down to the local, to the particular, to the individual, to give some sense of what this new technology, what this new business meant on an everyday level. And so I began inserting these railroad lives. And they are, as you say, very brief, very short vignettes, which capture, I think, something essential about this new technology, about how much it pervaded everyday lives, but also they capture the sort of nitty, gritty part of living in the 19th century.
Right. I mean, one of the things I came away from reading many of the vignettes was this sense of the industrializing of the West. I mean, these people were not living the romantic life on the range. Their lives have been transformed and reorganized along industrial models.
No, exactly. I mean, it's one, I think, of the lasting illusions we have about the West, is that corporations and modern industry penetrate the West very often before actual settlers do, Anglo-American settlers do. So the West is industrialized, is connected up with these markets. These are people working very dangerous industrial jobs that might seem in the middle of nowhere, but they're very dangerous industrial jobs. The railroads are the largest employers in the West. They're massive flows of capital. And this doesn't just affect the Jay Goulds and the Huntingtons and the Stanfords and the Crockers. This affects everybody who lives in the region. And you really can't understand why politically and socially they act like they do without recognizing that they're enmeshed in this system and that they know it. I mean, we forget it, but they knew it. They knew it intimately.
One of the things that you have a whole section in the book that talks about spatial politics and the whole changing of the concept of our relationship to space, which the railroads were so critical in doing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that historians have tended to neglect is the complexity of how railroads change space. And I can give you a couple of easy examples. We tend to think that, well, you know, trains moved faster than wagons, therefore everything got closer together. Well, that's one way of thinking about it, but if we think about it in another way, even if we think about it in terms of time, we know that space expands and contracts all the time. I live in Redwood City, which is near San Francisco. If I travel to San Francisco in the morning when there's rush hour, it takes me much longer to get there than if I travel at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But if you begin to measure it not so much by time, but by cost, you find that, in fact, since the railroads control the rates, they, in fact, control the software of transportation. It's not so much how fast things move, and they move very unevenly, as I point out in the book, but how much it costs. So what the farmers and merchants begin to realize is they are themselves on wheels, that you change the numbers on a table, you change the cost of moving a good from one place or another, and they move farther away from a destination, or they move closer to a destination. And the control is not theirs. The control is with the railroads. And this creates a huge amount of resentment because they begin to realize the very space they live in is under the control of corporations. And because it's so new to them, we've gotten used to this. We don't try to make sense of airline fares. But for them, this is brand new. This has never happened before. And they locate this as corporate power, and they resist that corporate power.
They also, of course, the railroads not only are having that social impact, but there's the economic impact in terms of creating or attempting to create markets which would not have otherwise have arisen. Instead of, you know, kind of the reverse, I mean, if you build something to support an existing market that's expanding.
Now, the major problem with the railroads, the transcontinental railroads, is they're built where they're not needed, and then they have to try to justify their existence and get enough traffic. And you could have not subsidized railroads, and they would have built up to the 98th or 100th meridian, about the middle of Kansas or Nebraska, with or without subsidies. And California would have had railroads that would have fed into San Francisco. But there was really no need for railroads between the 98th meridian and the Sierras or the Cascades. There certainly wasn't the need for multiple railroads. And as a matter of fact, for a long time, goods from California can move more cheaply and virtually as quickly by ship as they can through the railroads because of the inefficiencies of the railroad network. But what the railroads have to do, now they've built into all these places where there's no traffic, is to bring people in. And what you get is a catastrophe on the western Great Plains and large parts of the Rocky Mountains and the Great Basin and even large parts of the Pacific Northwest, where you draw people in, where they are induced to come by railroad advertisements, by deals and loans on land, by all kinds of promises about changing the climate. And they come in, and what we get is disaster. It's a disaster in some ways that we're still living with, because there's been a steady outflow of population from areas first settled by the railroads in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
And of course, one of the, I guess, carrots that the railroads are the people putting these transcontinentals together dangled in front of government was that whole idea of, there would be this land along the right-of-way, some of which the railroad would help develop, some of which would become potential revenue for the government.
Yeah, I mean, in principle, even the critics of the railroads recognize that the land grants are brilliant. What you do is you give half the lands and the land grants to the railroads, and you retain the rest for the government. The government will then double the price because it is more valuable land, so it's lost nothing. While the railroads, in selling their lands, which they have an inducement to sell cheaply because they need the traffic, will get the money to pay back the loans from the government and to pay back the loans from private investors. It seems like a free lunch. I mean, you will get settlement, you will get a transportation network, you will get these things built without any cost to the government. And like any free lunch, it goes terribly, terribly bad, both because they're built in places where this can't work and because they induce a kind of corruption and complexity that I think we're all too familiar with other things that have happened since then. I mean, in some ways, it's the same kind of claims that were made about the housing market, that cheap credit will take care of everything. Well, there's a long hangover from the railroads, and there's a long hangover from what happened in the housing market, and in some ways, they're very, very similar.
So, Were the railroads, were the transcontinentals, and I think, as you point out, it's important to differentiate between that because they're the ones that end up failing so dismally. Were the transcontinentals creating this environment of corruption, or what were the set of conditions that made this possible? Were they exploiting a pre-existing condition that came out of the Civil War, or what made it possible for them to fail on such a monumental scale?
Well, it's both. It's, they come into a set of conditions. Well, we have to remember in the late 19th century, Americans greatly feared corruption, and they associated corruption with corporations. So there's a great deal of opposition to this aiding of corporations because the argument is that they of course are going to become corrupt. And we also forget that the period we're talking about where this aid to corporations comes is relatively brief. It's from about 1865 to 1872. The rest of the century is spent trying to scratch back what they gave away. But in the wake of the Civil War, there is this both this is exhaustion from this war and an incredible kind of optimism. And I think it often happens in the wake of wars that there are kinds of opportunities which aren't available at other times in history, that there is a sort of easing of moral standards. So the railroads can move into that, and once they've got the gifts, once they've got the subsidies, once they've got the protection, then they will further corrupt the system to protect them. Most of the fighting in the 1870s is between railroads trying to protect what they already have rather than get much that's pretty new. So they both see this opportunity. I don't think this could have happened in 1873, but it could happen in 1865. One of the things we forget is warfare itself spawns corruption. The Lincoln administration was virtually as corrupt as the Grant administration. The railroads can take advantage of all this. There's a certain kind of laxity that can go on when there's this great national cause and that the means can seem to justify the ends, that everyone knows there's great fortunes that can be made in this. And this is in that way not all that atypical, except on the scale at which it happened.
One of the things, I mean, obviously, as you were laying out this story, a core of it is this incredibly complex series of financial transactions and literally forming new types of financial packages.
What's happening is very similar to today.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going
to
say.
They are inventing new ways to borrow money. I mean, essentially, this is what much of finance consists of. What we forget about the railroads is that in the late 19th century, they're not playing with their own money. There is very little money invested in stocks. What these guys have to do is get credit. They have to borrow money. So what they figure out is all these new kinds of securities, using all different kinds of things as collateral, in which to begin to sell the securities. And then they have to create value for the securities, and doing that they begin to realize is a matter of information. I mean, they invent one of the great fictional genres of the late 19th century, which is the stock report to the stockholders, these annual reports, which are utterly made-up documents. What's even more incredible as you get into it is they don't even know the financial condition of these companies, and they don't even really care because they're not trying to make money off of transportation. As long as they can sell the securities and get out, they are going to become rich. What the associates of the Central Pacific do is to take the Central Pacific, which is a railroad that is losing money. They borrow money in order to pay stock dividends. They hold all the stock. They pocket that money. They then show in the stockholders' report that, in fact, this appears to be a profit-making company. They then begin to market all of these securities to English investors, which they do very skillfully. They sell out the railroad, and then they take that railroad, and they lease it for 100 years to a company they still control, the Southern Pacific. So they've made a fortune selling a railroad which stockholders don't even control, and the traffic that it did have begins to flow through the Southern Pacific. They can do these kinds of things, and they do them.
I was at the time of reading that those portions of the book, it was like one could easily just put in Lehman Brothers as opposed to Union Pacific or Goldman Sachs. It seemed, the men in the octopus suits are just, creating this incredible environment.
Well, you can imagine what it was like writing it. I mean, a lot of times I'd have to step back and say, no, I'm writing about the 19th century. I mean, there is a kind of odd parallel between the moment I was writing the book and what was going on. I mean, the securities are different. We're talking about mortgages. We're not talking about railroad securities. And there's all kinds of differences. But the basic system seems so much the same. And the outcome seems so much the same that it's scary. Which makes it even scarier now is that the railroad collapses of the late 19th century didn't happen once. They happened in 1872. 72, 73. They happen again in 1882, 83. They happen again in 1893. The same problems occur over and over and over again. And as you know, as we sit here talking today on the verge of yet another double dip recession, and with the crisis in Europe, it seems to have these, you know, very, very strong parallels. Everybody says, oh, this is a series of coincidences that can only happen once. No, these are structural problems, and real structural problems that will continue to happen until you correct them.
And at the same time that you're, you know, having these, you know, flashes about our current situation, I'm sure you must have been feeling a closer bond with Mark Twain and his own portrayal of that Gilded Age.
Yeah, I mean, the great danger of the late 19th century is that the temptation to quote Mark Twain too much. I mean, there's Mark Twain. I mean, between Mark Twain and Herman Melville in the mid and late 19th century, there's nothing a historian has left to say. I mean, these guys are just brilliant. They capture it as it's going on before they could even know what's going to happen. They have gotten the essence of it down.
You know, we only have about a minute or so left, but I did want to touch on the fact that you do something interesting in this, and that you kind of close with an alternative history, which is a sort of an interesting idea.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that struck me is if history is going to be hopeful, then it can't be inevitable. And if it can't be inevitable, then one of the things a historian has to do is show that there are counterfactuals, that with a series of believable and relatively small changes, there were alternatives. And so one of the things I try to do in the book, which is anathema to some of my fellow historians, is to point out that, in fact, counterfactual history does have a purpose. You can't invent things, but you have to imagine that all of the people struggling in the past were struggling for a different and better world, even if they didn't attain it. Because if there isn't that opportunity for them, there isn't an opportunity for us, that the world just seems to be marked in that we're helpless and hopeless. And I think much of our own current political crisis is that so many Americans, both on the left and on the right, seem to feel that, in fact, these situations are utterly hopeless and can't be affected by them. And the late 19th century, people did not feel that way.
Well, now that you've been spending so much time with the robber barons, are you ready to move on to something else?
I am moving on, but it's going to be, unfortunately, a different part of the Gilded Age that I'm going to be writing for the Oxford History of the United States. I'll be writing their late 19th century volume. So I'm going to be spending some more time with my guys, but widening my acquaintances otherwise, other places in the 19th century.
It's a rich vein to tap into.
It certainly is.
Well, Professor Richard White, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today at KBOO about your new book, Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America.
It's been my pleasure.
You have a good day now.
Okay, you too, Dave.
Bye-bye.